It is Tuesday night, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show, and some great wrap-up after the Blackhawks game. Sadly, they did lose that one, but they were doing so great. And look, things are looking better every single day with the Blackhawks. So never fear. We are so happy that you're listening to the show. Hope that you're happy, healthy, and safe wherever you are tonight, in particular with these rather treacherous conditions outside. Please be safe out there. I know that last night was also pretty scary, so I think that you've already gotten that your guard up for this. So be well, and make sure that you take extra time in order to get wherever you're going. And if you do happen to need to go to sleep tonight and you feel like you know, maybe you missed something on the show or you want to hear the whole thing again, don't forget everything that we say here at WGN Radio and the Patty Vasquez Show is available on podcast. You can go to WGNradio.com and listen to that podcast when it's up. And I would love if you guys subscribe to my podcast. It's available wherever you listen to your shows, maybe on iTunes, iHeart, or TuneIn. So subscribe to the show. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter at Patty Vasquez, CHI, and it's Patty V Show on Facebook. For those listeners who are asking about that piece that I wrote about some of the bumps in the road that I've hit with Declan's recovery post-surgery. He had a spinal fusion surgery last summer, and we're still kind of battling some issues. So that piece is available on Patty V Show on Facebook page. And I want to thank so many of our Facebook friends who have sent such kind words and thoughts. And we've actually gotten some phone calls from our family and friends. And my husband's like, you need to give me a little warning when you share a piece of our life like that. Senator Dan Katowski joins us in studio. I don't know if you had a chance to read the piece that I wrote.
Oh, sure.
I don't often pull the curtain back that, like, I let people peek at what it's like raising Declan, but I rarely really say how hard it can be. And then I realize that I'm kind of being dishonest to parents like me who maybe look at our family and go, I wish I was like them, making them think somehow like we always have a smile on our face and we've got our act together, when really that's the brave face we give to the world. And it's also a way for us to sort of trick ourselves into thinking everything's okay sometimes. And I think this post-surgery has been the hardest part of Declan's life since he was born. So so I want to thank everybody for their kind words.
Sure.
And you work with a lot of families like mine. Senator Dan Katowski is also the president of ChildServe, and I want you to let folks know, maybe people who haven't heard you on the show before, tell us what ChildServe does for families.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be on again. And you know, you were talking about Declan and making sure that people understand really what you've been going through, and quite frankly, that it's okay to share with other people what you're going through, because it helps people to understand what it really is needed in terms of support. And I think you know, it's something you and I've talked about for years. There's so much, there's so much strain and pressure on families that in order to keep it together and look like everything's okay. And this is where support comes in, and this is where understanding comes in. And that's what we try to do with ChildServe. We make sure we build better lives for children and families who are at risk, so they can reach their full potential. And a lot of that comes with telling stories, honest stories about what's happened in the lives of our kids, and to make sure people know that look, you know, here's what trauma looks like. You know, trauma looks like someone, you know, a child has grown up in a home with domestic violence. Mm-hmm. Trauma looks like, you know, your parents aren't necessarily involved in your lives, or your father left at a young age, or your father's in prison, or your mother abandoned you when you're a child. Trauma is something that stays with you. And what we try and do is make sure every opportunity for our kids to, you know, be protected first and foremost, and to understand how to heal from the trauma that they've been through, and so that they can become educated, and so they have the best life possible. So I mean, it's really you're providing a service to people when you share that story, because it empowers others to, you know, have the courage to share their own story. And what we're doing all the time is making sure that, you know, we had a story recently in the Chicago Tribune. It was a front page story, and it's so rare that this happens, where you have a front page story about a young man in our program named Johnny, who was homeless, and now he's no longer homeless, and he's working full time, and he's building stages at the Lyric Opera. And it's an extraordinary story. And in the news all the time, we hear here's what's going on in people's lives, and and so much of the negative is shared, or not the full story of what's happened in the lives of children and families and what people are dealing with. And so it was a wonderfully complete and full story, and it highlighted both his trials and his successes. And it also highlighted the problem with youth homelessness in the city of Chicago and the extent that we're grappling with it on a daily basis, and what we need to do for kids, you know, who basically are just looking for a place to stay, so they're no longer couch surfing or sleeping in cars or sleeping under bridges, so they have an opportunity to be safe and secure, but also have a plan for success for the rest of their life. And that's what we're doing at ChildServe. Let's figure out a way to protect kids first and foremost, make sure they're healing from the trauma they're going through, and then they have every opportunity to achieve success in life. So, when I hear you talk about Declan, and we've known each other for years, sadly, the numbers don't persuade people. You know, when we talked about in the state of Illinois, there were 15,000 children with autism who weren't getting services. Well, what does that mean? What does that look like? That's a big number. Mm-hmm. And autism is sometimes it's a designation or a diagnosis that people don't get, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's like, well, I'm going to tell you about my family. I'm going to tell you about my struggles. And what you're doing with Declan is, I think, empowering a lot of other people and making sure people are plugged in a very personal way so they can make more informed decisions.
Thank you. Well, and as you know, Declan has a neurological disorder called agenesis of the corpus callosum. And because of the piece that I wrote and because I talked about his spinal fusion surgery, somebody was posting about their child and they were scared. So, it's this network on social media where one mom goes, oh, I just read something about a mom who was going through this, and you have questions, maybe she can help you out, even though her, the piece I wrote was sort of this bump in the road, and, the sort of a rocky, path that I'm on. But I was able to then write to this mom and say, look, this is what it was like. This is the severity of where Declan's curvature of his spine was. This was how long the surgery lasted. This is what we were told to expect. This is what actually happened. And he is recovering. He doesn't have the endurance he used to have. He doesn't have the interest in exploring that he used to have. And that's been the hard part for me. But the corpus callosum disorder is a part of the brain is missing. And so I usually write things on Facebook like walking with autism, because everything he has looks very similar to autism. And I know that you have in your program in ChildServe, there are kids who receive services like Declan did from early intervention, because there is, whether it's a child who has a disability or perhaps a child that hasn't gotten some of the, resources in order to be able to walk or sit up or, start to count at a certain age. Tell us, what has the winter been like for the children in your care at ChildServe?
Well, it's been difficult. And I think it's been difficult because, number one, they're not able to get the support and care that they need because of, in many cases, the weather has either confined people to being indoors, or it's prevented, in many cases, people who provide the work from getting to see people because it's been very dangerous to be outside. Fortunately, we are a team of people at ChildServe who basically ignore the weather.
They're tireless. The people I've met.
Yeah, they go there and they're like, you know what? I get it. I know it's dangerous to be outside, but we're going to be with the kids and we're going to make sure they're okay first, because at ChildServe, our value is we treat the children in our care as if they were our own kids. And what would you do in the situation with your own child's life? The challenge we faced is in one of our group homes, we had 8 radiators burst. And so we had 8 radiators burst, and then so the heat wasn't working, and we had a little bit of a flood in the house. So we've had to move our girls to a hotel temporarily. And people are like, well, is it a hotel? That's nice that you're able to do that. No, it's just another moment of instability in a life that has an incredible amount of instability, where if you've been in multiple foster homes, then finally you're at a house and your house is comfortable and the heat works and it's clean and you have good food and you have people are with you on a daily basis. And then you're moved out of your house. I was talking about this today with somebody, and I said, look, like, well, they're all okay. I was like, yeah, they're okay. But imagine what it's like if you're at your own house, if the heat wasn't working.
Yeah.
And your life was disrupted. And our goal is to make sure we provide stability and support for kids, so they make sure that they are getting the protection and care that they need so they can have the best life possible. And if we're not able to do that, so the weather hasn't been our best friend, we've worked a way around that. So we're working right now. We replaced 8 radiators, and that costs a significant amount of money because it's a home for girls that we have who are teenagers. And so that's been a little bit of a challenge. And it's a challenge, like I said, for people to get out and visit our clients. So our commitment was during this cold spell or the polar vortexes, we made sure every single one of our clients was called, every one of our families was reached out to. Are you okay? Do you need anything? What can we do for you? And it gets back to when you were talking earlier, Patty, like our value, right, is we believe all children, mm-hmm. you know, deserve the same opportunity to achieve their full potential. And when we start to talk about stories about all kids, regardless of what their challenge is, whether they have a developmental challenge or whether they have autism or a special need or a learning disability or they have ADHD or they have, you know, an IEP for any number of reasons, all kids. What are we doing to make sure all kids are able to achieve their full potential? And again, by sharing these stories, people understand, like, well, I have kids and I'd run through a wall for my child, right?
Right.
And you mean to tell me your child that's under your care, the only thing that separates your child from my child is the fact that they can't be in a warm house, or they're not able to get a mentor. Like my child gets a coach, an individual coach for soccer, or my child gets a tutor. Your child isn't able to get a mentor or a tutor, or you're not able to have money set aside for college.
Or even have their own shelf at home. You were talking about being in a hotel. People think that that's kind of cool, but yeah. Imagine finally having a place that you can keep your things, your belongings, and not worry about, well, when you come home, everything's going to be
right,
okay.
Right. Yeah. Well, if your life has been transient, you don't want it to be.
Right. We're going to take a break here. This is not the first time Senator Dan Katowski has worked fearlessly and tirelessly for the children of Illinois. I want to talk a little bit about his work as a senator and as well as working on the transition team for Governor Pritzker for Children and Families on the committee. More after this on 720 WGN. It's the Patty Vasquez Show. If you want to join us, we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. We can also find out how you can help Child Serve if you'd like to get out there and roll your sleeves up. 312-981-7200. Senator Dan Katowski joins us on the Patty Vasquez Show, WGN Radio, 720 AM. And we actually met because I was performing at the Epilepsy Foundation fundraiser several years ago. You came up to me, started talking, and you were really just so invested in the children of Illinois. You helped me out and you guided me through what it's like to go down to Springfield and talk to legislators about getting things done. You stepped down from your seat as a senator, as a beloved senator in your district, and except for the folks who don't like the noise
except
at O'Hare Airport.
The 40% didn't vote for me.
Stop. The folks who don't like the noise at O'Hare Airport.
That's right.
Like you have any control. Put those planes down. Well, you and Ocasio-Cortez probably have something together. Anyway, you can agree on no more planes. Okay, so not you, them. That's who, they don't want any more planes. So you have done such great work at Child Serve, and I know that Governor Pritzker has turned to you to work on the transition team for the Child and Family Committee to work on what's going to happen next in the state of Illinois. What have you guys been working on?
Well, he did a really nice job of getting a large number of people who are involved in all facets of human services. So there was I was one of, you know, probably 30 or 40 people on that committee. And what we really were emphasizing is like, okay, it's a new day in human services. Governor Pritzker understands the importance that when you invest in children and families, it actually does make a difference. And so it's nice to see that the philosophy has changed. And one of the things we really were focusing on is there's a tremendous amount of instability in the workforce for people who are, each day, we're mission-driven mm-hmm. people who believe in human services. There's a lot of turnover. And in some cases, it's 50% turnover or 55%. And it's very disruptive to the care of children. Mm-hmm. And it's, like I said before, if you're a child and you faced a lot of instability in your life and a lot of, you know, unpredictability and just people you can't count on or rely on, and then next thing you know, you're working with an agency and you're supposed to have that at least a certain level of consistency there. But then you'll have three different caseworkers in a span of 3 months. Mm-hmm. That just is, you know, that's insult to injury. So with the Governor Pritzker through this Healthy Children and Families Transition Team, and a lot of people from, you know, private sector, public sector, nonprofit sector, it all came together and they basically said, look, we have to invest in the people who are doing the work so our kids can get the consistency of care that they deserve. And that conversation has been a kind of a bifurcated conversation. It's like, what do you mean invest in people who are doing the work? I mean, they should just be doing it for the sake of doing it. And it's not people, they're already doing it. They're mission-driven, passionate, loving people. But if you can't live on that salary, if you're doing two to three jobs, and if you're burning out, we're not doing what we need to do for our kids.
In our experience with our family and a lot of my friends who have children with disabilities, what we've learned over the years is a lot of different factors have contributed to that big turnover. Part of it really was the state not making payments, because a lot of those groups had to take out loans. It drove many of them out of business. You know, the ABA therapists that we were relying on, there were even in hospitals, they said, look, I can't take any more early intervention kids if the state of Illinois cannot pay the bills. And early intervention is a federally mandated program. It's partially funded by the federal government, but the state of Illinois wasn't making their payments. So you're right, the instability of their financial future to know, you know, to think that, well, we don't know what next month brings, has to make people look at other things.
Yeah, it's not only is it incredibly stressful for families, it's incredibly stressful for children. It's incredibly stressful for the agencies who have banks knocking at the door and say, well, you borrowed money from us. When are you going to pay it off?
Yeah.
We literally had a relationship with a bank. And after a couple years of, you know, this, what was going on in the state of Illinois, waiting to get money paid back, we finally were able to turn things around because we raised more money from people from the private sector and foundations and individuals, but also government was more consistent. Finally turned around. Then a bank said to us, it's like, okay, we're going to call out your loan. And so what does that mean for an organization like ours?
Right.
Fortunately, we were able to go to another bank that was more understanding, and we got a better deal, and we're in a better situation. But organizations like that, this is the part that's never really discussed, because if you have to stay in business, you're just like any other business. You have people that you borrow money from at banks and financial institutions. They have expectations, rightly so. But some of them, like, even if you're just paying the money back, they're like, you know what? We're done with you because we think you're too much of a risk. And I can see why that in the state of Illinois. But then what happens there is that all these organizations have been waiting to get paid for the state, are then forced in many aspects to either close their doors or reduce their programs and lay off massive number of employees. Fortunately, we didn't have to do any of that. And that was my commitment from the get-go when we started. It's like, we're going to do whatever we can to keep our doors open and not lay people off. Other organizations were not as fortunate. We had a lot of things break our way. But when you look at the state of Illinois, I think what this transition team has been all about, what the Governor Pritzker is all about, is like, let's figure out a way to consistently invest in the people who are doing the work so we can stabilize human services, so we can build a better Illinois for all people, right? And so, like, you and I have talked about this, and it's amazing to me that there isn't a recognition. You talk about a family value, that 80% of people who have children with developmental challenges, 80% of, there's a divorce rate of 80%.
Yeah. And people never believe me when I tell them that number.
And they're like, no,
you can
no.
look that up. Yeah.
And it's so hard. But you think about people and how difficult it also is to be a foster parent and getting that stability there. It's like, because that is real challenging work.
Yeah.
And if you're a foster parent and you're trying to get the support, but you don't have any additional support from a caseworker, that becomes that much more difficult.
And we are going to return to this conversation in the later, I believe, probably around in a little bit. We're going to come back to this conversation. We're going to check in with Chef Mario Rosati when we come back after the news. And we encourage you to contact us, call or text 312-981-7200 anytime.
Beat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken. Have some more pie. It doesn't matter.
Well, we have someone who will tell us just how to eat some stuff. We have Iron Chef Judge Mario Rosati on the line with us. Hello, Chef. How are you doing tonight?
Hello, hello, hello. Good evening. I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Doing very well. I want to introduce you to my good friend, Senator Dan Katowski, who joins me in studio.
Hello, how are you?
Senator, how are you?
I'm good.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Now, you are not only a TV personality, a culinary judge, you also are a brand ambassador for olive oil and for Italian, Real Italian Products, right? Is that the name of the company, Real Italian Products?
No. I'm a brand ambassador for authentic Italian products. I do work with a few Italian companies that they actually bring authentic Italian product in the United States.
Uh-huh.
One of them is called Fabri, for example. They bring an amazing quality cherry. I know there's nothing to do with olive oil, but just to give you an idea. And then basically I try to educate people around the country as an Italian culinary expert to understand the difference of, like I tell everybody, the same line, the difference between the Ferrari and the red car.
Between the Fagotti and the red
Ferrari.
Ferrari.
I'm like, did I say something bad? No. Did I say a bad word?
No. I didn't hear anything, so I don't know. I'm still learning English. So
I was afraid that I accidentally said like a bad Italian word or something. Okay, a Ferrari and a red car.
Yeah.
That one is translated in the food business. So therefore, I'm trying to educate this great population of the United States to understand the difference of a real Italian product versus the fake ones that they are here, and also how to use the product in the right recipe, the authentic Italian way, because we have an amazing variety of American Italian cuisine, which I appreciate it, I respect, but there is not too much authentic Italian cuisine yet, as much as I want to see it.
So how do we know when we're in the grocery store and we're standing in that aisle with the huge, that big wall of olive oils and EVOO and, you know, imported from Italy or imported from Greece or from California? What are we looking for? How do we choose the right olive oils?
So that will take about four of your episodes, but
that's fine. Here's episode one.
Episode one. So first of all, I'll teach you a trick, Penny. And to you, Senator, as well, you might be already aware of it, but I like to remind the listener. If you're looking for something from a specific country, in this case, because I'm Italian, I represent Italian product. If I'm looking for an authentic Italian product, if the word on the label says made in Italy or packed in Italy or imported from Italy, it is a very high chance that they're not Italians.
So they're not Italians?
They are not Italians, correct. So what I do look for on the label is the word product of.
Oh no.
So product of Italy, product of Greece, or product of Spain, it's from those specific countries. And, when you say imported from Italy, it means really that the product is being shipped from the country of Italy. But not necessarily that the product has been made with Italian ingredients.
Wow.
Interesting.
Everyone in the studio's minds are blown.
Because there is a lot of tricks around. It's the same thing of many things that we have that are made in USA. Product of USA, we know 100% is a product from this country and assembled in this country, and then everything comes from this country. But made in USA sometimes could be a very big gray area. Same thing for made in Italy or packed in Italy. I'll give an example, Patty. I'm pretty sure you're a big fan of Italian purses and Italian shoes, but you know, last time I see an alligator in my country was a long time ago. You know what I'm trying to say? So those are made in Italy products, but they are not product of Italy because the main product, the main material doesn't come from the country of Italy. Doesn't mean they're no good. We're not going to talk about quality yet, but at least opens up the eyes of the consumer to understand the difference already of what they are buying. If it says made in Italy or imported from Italy and you still want to buy it, I am okay with that as long as you're aware of what you actually are taking home and how much you pay for it. Because, again, this goes back to the famous Ferrari and the red car. I mean, you paying for the Ferrari, but you're going home with the red car, and it's not necessarily probably the right price to pay for it. So when you go in a store, first of all, look for product of Italy or for whatever country you like. Second of all, it is very hard, unless you taste the extra virgin olive oil, to understand the quality of it. And there is also multiple application for different varieties of olive oils. When you think about olive oil, think about a good wine. Mm-hmm. And so different grapes make different wines, while different olives will have a different flavor and different aftertaste and a different good extra virgin olive oil that comes out of it.
So when you are looking for this, the olive oil, now we understand that we should look for the words product of Italy. What distinguishes Italian olive oil? What is it that we're looking for, and what makes it superior for you? Because I know that you're passionate about this.
I'm very passionate about extra virgin olive oil. But first of all, every country has a good extra virgin olive oil. So I disagree when people come to me and they say, oh, Greek olive oil is better than Italian. Italian is better than Spanish. Spanish is better than Moroccan. Unfortunately, we cannot compare different kind of extra virgin olive oil if they are actually coming from different countries, so different olives as well. So it's like saying sometimes the wrong thing, meaning that you say that a red wine from the United States is better from a red wine from France. Well, that's very vague. So you need sure. to get down into the kind of grapes you're using and then, you know, the land where they come from. So with extra virgin olive oil, it is the same thing. It just, it depends what you use it for, and number one. Number two also, again, one of my favorite extra virgin olive oil this year was from Croatia. And they're doing a great job also in extra virgin olive oils. But also Italian, they produce a lot of it. And in Italy, we have the highest variety of olives growing in a single country throughout the whole planet. So it's just, there is a lot of olive oil that we can produce. And it's hard to define exactly what you want to take home, but you got to learn how to taste it as well, which is another technique that is very unique because it will release in your palate a different flavor profile of the extra virgin olive oil as well.
Now, people always look at the labels and they're looking for words. You know, they've heard, is it Rachel Ray that made everyone say EVOO? I don't remember it being that prevalent in our sort of dialect or the way we talked about olive oil. What is the difference between pure and or virgin olive oil compared to others?
So thank you, Rachel Ray. If you hear me, please, I would love to be on your show one day together with Penny Vasquez. But EVO is an abbreviation, as you know, for extra virgin olive oil. What's the difference? So number one, a lot of people are looking on the label for the words first cold press. And they think the words first cold press are synonymous of main reason why it's called extra virgin olive oil. That is a translation, and it became almost a marketing word to put on the labels, because if you go to Italy, like I go almost every year, you know that the press of the olives, it actually happens in an area or in a room, which is anywhere from 70 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is not much cold about that. And we don't only press it once, and then all of a sudden we throw away the olives. So the best way to understand it is something that it is defined by the percentage of acidity that is contained after you press these olives. So you pick the olives, you try to press them as fast as you can. You're going to bring them into a machine that will get rid of the leaves. It will wash them, and then you put them into a press. The press is going to start to work. There is a nice, beautiful liquid gold that will come out of this press. This liquid gold will go into an organoleptic laboratory analysis. That analysis will reveal a percentage of acidity that you cannot perceive in your mouth. That is going to be, it has to be below 0.8% to be called extra virgin. Then we have 0.9 to 2% is called virgin olive oil. Then 2.1 to 3% is called pure olive oil. And after that, unfortunately, we have also what we don't like to see in the kitchens of anyone, which unfortunately is leftover skin and pits of the olives repressed again. Occasionally is not the right word, many times, injected with formaldehyde. Oh. And then they will actually grow the mass again, and then it will be pressed again, so you can actually get more liquid out of it. But I highly suggest to people stay away from that kind of product, like pomace oil, or, you know, that stuff that in Italy we use to fill up the portable electrical radiators as well. But in America, I see it in many, many restaurants.
So basically, mechanics oil is that final press. And you said they add formaldehyde to that occasionally?
They do, yeah, because formaldehyde that makes you, you know, one day they're going to put it on me too, and it's going to make me look nice and puffy for the next extra few hours. But when it's going to grow the mass again, it's going to give the opportunity to the machine to press again and get more liquid out of the leftover skin and pits of the olives.
Oh, wow. That's what the formaldehyde does.
Yes, Senator, is between disgusting and I don't know what other word to use it, but
practical.
It is very cheap in every single meaning of the word to produce, and it's very cheap to buy. And you see it most likely in many restaurants. Not all of them, but many restaurants around the world that people use it because it's cheap. And, you know, it's just, I'm sorry, the word cheap probably should have the listener understand that it's the worst of the worst that you can get.
So can we ask what your, well, let me take a break here. Do you mind, would you mind holding on for another segment, Mario?
I don't mind. I'll be more than happy. I'm expecting also a nice question from Senator as well.
Yes, that's
so
exactly.
He really knows about olive oil too.
I've been writing down notes. So far in this segment, I've learned look for the words product of Italy. Good olive oil can come from various countries, including Croatia. And extra virgin oil
and
has to.
Moroccan, too. Did you hear that?
Moroccans, all these are things that we're. I hope everyone's taking their notes because Mario's going to test you when we come back.
Yes.
All right. More in a moment with Mario Rosati when we come back on 720 WGN. You can call or text us if you have any questions or comments. 312-981-7200. You are listening to the Patty Vasquez Show. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Joining me is Senator Dan Katowski. On the line with us is Iron Chef Judge Mario Rosati, and he is teaching us about olive oil, which I think I knew I wanted more information, and now I feel like I could just listen to Mario talk about olive oil for hours. And this is session one, right, Mario?
This is great.
Yeah, session one, but I got more ideas for you as well, for all the listeners that were online before and listening as well. A funny part is also, you asked me how to recognize a good olive oil in the store.
Yes.
And there are other few things that I want to add on, and one of them was make sure that your extra virgin olive oil at least comes in a dark green bottle.
Okay.
Mm. And that because it's actually sunlight, will actually do not give the chance to the olive oil to oxidate as fast. So when you have your olive oil also, do not leave it by a window in direct sunlight, but put it away from heat and sunlight if you can, and find the perfect spot because it is very hard to. Some people say, "So I will put it under the sink. It's dark." Yeah, but the pipes run hot water and they will warm up the area. Or they might say, "I'll put it in my cabinet on top of the fridge or next to my oven." Those are all sorts of heat, and those things will change. And it will actually get that the olive oil to start to get lower and lower from the original quality that you really expect. Because don't forget, extra virgin olive oil, it is the number one ingredient of a Mediterranean diet. Therefore, it's one of the healthiest ingredients of your diet. So wherever you go, if you go to Europe, you see extra virgin olive oil is in every single recipe. We put it from desserts to anything that you can actually think about it, we actually use extra virgin olive oil. We put them on desserts. We put them not only on salad. We drizzle it at the end of every single dish that we make. And we want to make sure that we use that as an addition to the great dish that we already did and to enhance the quality of your dish. Because my favorite olive oil, for example, one of them, comes from Sicily, comes from the mountain of Iblei. And when you open those bottles of extra virgin olive oil, it smells like tomatoes right off the vines.
Interesting.
But they're not flavored olive oils. That's the quality of the olives. They will release a different smell, a different characteristic. It could smell like tomatoes right off the vine. It could smell like turnips. It could smell like artichokes. It could smell like pine nuts. It could smell like fresh cut grass. So there is a culture behind extra virgin olive oil that for me it's a passion, and thanks to the Barilla family, when I started many years ago to learn about extra virgin olive oil, thanks to them they gave me the opportunity to get more and more and to learn more and more about extra virgin. But for now, Betty, one day and Senator, you invited both to my house, but you can see in my cabinet there is 8 different bottles of extra virgin olive oil, one for every single different application.
Mario, I feel like I've met the Italian version of me. I could have used you on the Senate floor, speaking to like an issue, because you go
I'm
and you're listen. I have a question for you. First of all, where did you get the name Iron Iron Chef.
Wow. Judge. He's a judge on Iron Chef. He's passed judgment.
A TV show on the Food Network.
Do they call you like IC, Iron Chef? Do they for sure?
They call me an Italian culinary expert. That is the main name they give me.
What's your nickname in Italian? What do they call you in Italian?
My nickname. They just actually shorten my name, but there is nothing related to my work in Italian. But everybody called me Mariucci, instead of Mario. That's actually, when I go to Italy, I even actually visit some olive oil productions and some nice, beautiful crops of olives. And even the producers, they sometimes call me and they ask me if I can actually go and test that olive oil.
Would you take people on a tour of like Italy to where get the best olive oil? Like some people go to vineyards?
I do that occasionally because it's far away, so not too many people can actually just jump on a plane and come. But what I do tours in the United States where I go to many restaurants and they hire me to do an Italian event where together with my colleague, Chef Adam Weisel, I travel throughout the country and we go in restaurants and we do authentic Italian dinners in these restaurants. And you can get more information on my website, which is www.mariorizzotti.com. And what you can do, you can come there. We do olive oil tasting through the night. And it's funny because, Patty and Senator, you will see on the table a bunch of shot glasses, and people think that we're doing shots of tequila or something. But realistically, we actually tasting extra virgin olive oil. And the best way to taste it is not with bread, is not with food, but it's on its own. So we do shots of olive oil.
Well, I need a favor then, Mario. I need you to come in studio for session two and bring me shots of olive oil. As Mario mentioned, his website is mariorizzotti.com. You can also follow him on Instagram, on Twitter. And we want you to come in studio. I'm going to contact your people and say we're going
to
need some shots.
I wanted to be there this time.
That's okay.
But as of now, actually, I'm calling you from Michigan, where there is a very bad snowstorm right now.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. I would love to come to your studio and
session two.
Most likely, if you can re-invite also our senator, so we can actually talk more about this.
Perfect.
Love it.
Done. We'll make it happen. Be safe, Mario, and stay warm. And we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you so much, my friend.
Grazie. Thank you for having me. Buonanotte. Good night, senator. And look forward to coming to the floor with you one day.
Buena suerte.
That's Spanish, but I'll take it.
Good luck. What's the Italian version?
I'm going to give him a hard time when we get off the air. But thanks. Goodbye.
Buona fortuna.
I'm sorry, I messed up. Buona fortuna.
Now you're making me late. Thank you, gentlemen. More after this on 720 WGN. Coming up on February 24th, it's the Academy Awards. And, of course, it wouldn't be Academy Awards season these days without a little controversy. Joining us in studio is Matt Fagerholm from RogerEbert.com and IndieOutlook.com as well. I got it this time, right?
Oh, you got it.
I always took a breath this time.
You're great.
No, I usually look at my notes this time, but I did not get it. I did not. I took a breath. I thought about it. And I introduced you already, of course, to Senator Dan Katowski. I told him you would be here for Academy Awards conversation.
This is an honor. I'm excited. This is great.
I'm excited.
I know we're all revved up to talk about this anyways. So.
Well, you know, I heard the news on my way home last night listening to Nick DiGilio's show.
Yeah.
And he was right out of the gate fuming about this. So tell us what the Academy has decided in order to shorten the length of time that the Academy Awards is on our television.
Yes. So the Academy and their infinitely limited wisdom, I have to say, by slimming down the show, what they need to do is they have to start cutting things. And when you look at the telecast, you can see many things that can be cut. Certain sketches, certain segments, certain endless montages that could just easily be lifted and just shave that off. But what they've decided is to take certain awards out of the live part of the show and show them later in an edited format. Now, we've seen that in other award shows where all of a sudden it's like, and this person won this, and here's one person they thanked, and let's move on. And they don't give the person the time allotted to all the other people to, you know, have their moment, you know, and not just that, but cutting the names of the nominees. I assume they probably won't be naming the other films nominated in that category. And what I think they should do for everyone who's nominated is have that moment. Here's this person. Here's their name. Here's a little image or clip of their work to honor these people. But right. that's but no. So they've decided it's on a rotating basis. 4 to 6 categories will be taken from the show and placed in this. You know, later in the show, this is what you didn't see, and they'll be presented during the commercial breaks. Is what will happen
when you say 4 to 6? That means that 4 to 6
categories
ongoing from now on.
Yes, and it'll be on a rotating basis. So whatever is removed from the show and shown later in this abridged version, that will be guaranteed a live slot next year. But then 4 other categories
we'll get,
and it's not, I guess it's not technically X, but it still feels that way because it's
so
abbreviated. It's not respectful. Really not respectful to what is being sacrificed here.
I feel like you have some thoughts on it. You're like, what's happening?
Well, I'm just wondering which categories they're
going to
pick.
Here we go.
Oh, here it is. Okay, so I assumed, okay, well, if they're going to be cutting stuff, it'll be all the short films because most people haven't seen the short films. Obviously, I don't want anything cut, but I assumed that's what it was going to be. Instead, there's only one of them, the live action short. So we're going to get animated short and documentary short in the show, but live action short is not, so which is weird. Then makeup and hairstyling. Okay, it's one of the, you know, I guess considered lesser, even though it's not. I mean, and that's one thing. You love to see the behind the scenes of how they did the prosthetics and all of that, and all that's going to be cut.
Christian Bale attributes most of his performance on
absolutely,
and so did Gary Oldman in a lot
absolutely
of best actor and actress categories. So yeah,
yes. So I think that's ridiculous. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. Uh-oh. It's angering everyone, including Mr. Tom Hush.
I think Tom left the room.
He left the room because he's so angry. Cinematography and editing. All right. Cinematography and editing. That's two of the most crucial parts of the filmmaking process. Will now just be in this abridged little version, you know, later on in the show. And that just kills me.
I believe Tom left the room in order to grab some water so he could throw it on his face and go, okay, I'm ready to have this conversation.
Absolutely.
So cinematography and editing, and in particular, Tom was telling me before the show, you know, in particular, you have two directors, I believe, who are nominated in these categories as well. Basically, they are crucial in how the film ends up looking, whether it's in the initial shots or later deciding how the story is told.
Yes, like Alfonso Cuarón, I think he's pretty much guaranteed the Oscar for Roma, and it is one of the most visually astonishing films you've seen all year. You have to see it on a big screen to get the full impact of it. But, I mean, editing especially, actually even more so than cinematography. I don't want to say it's more important, but editing determines what wins Best Picture in many cases. That in many cases, it's usually, okay, who's up for director, who's up for editing? That will usually help you determine what ends up getting the big prize. So I'm just stunned that those two will not be in the live part of the show.
Yes, Tom.
Well, I just wanted to chime in with what I consider a good example of how much an editor can mean to a filmmaker. One of the greatest filmmakers of the last 20 to 25 years, Quentin Tarantino, was really well known for working with an editor by the name of Sally Menke.
Yes.
And she edited everything. She did
Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Kill Bill, Inglourious. We can say that.
Yeah, you can say Bastards.
Yes, Bastards.
She was the secret weapon. She knew exactly how to massage the script. She knew exactly what to take out, and it just moved so well. His movies moved so well.
And then, unfortunately, she passed away. Yeah. And his film after that, Django Unchained, which I still enjoyed, but you could tell there was something different.
Yes.
It was a little bit messier. It felt a little bit too elongated at times.
Yes.
And so...
And it was. I mean, there were huge, long patches that could have easily been trimmed.
Yeah, a lot of people really said that she was instrumental to making Quentin Tarantino's vision what it was. He's a great artist in of himself, but behind every great director, there's a great editor. And sometimes those are the same people. Sometimes it's even their spouses. George Miller, who did the Mad Max series, his wife edited Fury Road, which was famously... like literally hundreds of hours of footage.
Oh my God.
And he just shot it. He set up and shot it. She really made that movie. And he has stated that his wife, she basically made Fury Road a movie.
Yes.
He just shot all of it.
And who got the major BAFTA prize was Martin Scorsese's longtime editor, Thelma.
Yeah.
Thelma Schoonmaker, I believe. She's an essential part of what makes Scorsese himself. The Joe Pesci scene in Goodfellas would not be what it is without her.
Okay, so I'm going to leave you with this for the break to ponder how you're going to answer this for listener Aaron Moy, who asks, when was the last time you left the theater saying, wow, that film was well edited? I think you kind of answered it, but Tom just threw his headphones across the room. So you guys go ahead and take a moment to answer Aaron's question. When was the last time you left the theater thinking, wow, that film was well edited? More in a moment on 720 WD.
Absolutely.
Matt's still staring at me like, all right, do I really have to answer?
Oh, no. I was mentally thinking. I know exactly what I'll say.
All right, then, Senator, you'll have to have your answer as well. 312-981-7200. How do you want to answer, Aaron? It's just fun. Now your name comes up on the screen. I apologize. So the question on the table was from our listener, Aaron. We were talking about the categories of the Academy Awards that have been whittled out of the show, at least during the live broadcast, to be aired in an edited version later on. The Academy Awards are on February 24th. And joining us in studio is Matt Fagerholm from RogerEbert.com and InsiderOutlook.com. And we also have Senator Dan Katowski joining us on the Patty Baskett Show, 720 WGN. Okay, so Aaron wants to know, when was the last time you left the theater saying, wow, that film was well edited?
Yes, I can definitely describe it. And this is on my blog, Indie Outlook, actually. I will say, I spoke about a film called Baby Driver that I think is one of the best edited films I've ever seen. And what was so brilliant about that, it was a guy who was obsessed with music. He's obsessed with the rhythm of music. So everything in the film moves to the rhythm of the music. The editing moves to the rhythm of the music. They had a choreographer on the set choreographing everything moved to that rhythm, and it was just some of the best editing I've ever seen.
So there you go.
So, I mean, the first thing I said when I walked out was that was a well edited movie. So
there you go. How about you, Tom?
Another music one is Whiplash.
Absolutely,
Damien Chazelle's debut picture. The thing is about editing is that it's often a case of having to see the forest through the trees. You have all these individual scenes, and you have to make something of them. Specifically in Whiplash, the final sequence, which is like, I guess, the drum battle between J.K. Simmons and Miles Teller.
Yes, a fight for power between those two characters. And the little looks that they give each other.
Absolutely.
The whole time. Yes.
And you feel the rhythm. You're moving. You feel the tenseness. You feel the anxiety of the moment. And that's not to say that Damien Chazelle, the director, didn't shoot these with the intention of trying to make that the scene, but his editor had to come in there and essentially build the emotion. When people watch movies, they're engaged in the story, they're engaged in the characters. They don't see it as a series of cuts, which is essentially what a movie is. Mm. Our idea of narrative film is just a series of cuts that are intended to make you feel a certain way. That's not to say directors aren't important, cinematographers, acting, and all that kind of stuff, but the editor makes it this grand sort of tapestry that makes you feel emotion. The editor wants you to feel certain things with the shots that they're choosing to put in and the way they put it in, the rhythm that they cut to. So if a movie is edited well, you might not even realize that it's well edited. You just feel the emotion.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I mean, there are awards given for so many different technical aspects of a movie. Do you sit there and go, well, this sounds really good? Right. No, but there are aspects of it that it really do.
I guess if it's working, it's not sticking out to you.
Right.
It should just flow together.
It should. And that's what I think you guys are, you know, and I think
because we look for that. That's the thing.
Exactly.
It's our job to look for that.
You
stuff
look for those things. Yeah. And I think there are moments when we've probably seen, Senator, we've seen movies where we've gone, oh, that was, I love the way that unfolded. I love the way that story was told. And part of such a big part of that, as they're describing, is done in the editing.
If you walk out of a movie and you think, my God, that really needed to be edited, that means the editor didn't do his or her job.
Sure.
And so that's when, and that's whether with writing a book or an article or anything like that. And also the editor isn't just somebody who comes in and cuts it down. It's somebody who said, you know what, this isn't heading in the right direction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it may make that suggestion. I struggled with The Star Is Born. I know people love that movie, and I struggled with.
Yes, let's talk about this.
I struggled with it.
Sure,
I just struggled with it. I was like, really, really. When he makes the decision to basically, for those of you who haven't seen the movie,
he makes a very big decision.
Big decision,
yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And I struggled with it. I was like, you know what? It didn't fit for me,
mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, who had that conversation? Because when it's something sticks out like that in the course of an entire movie, and just the same way with a short story, you're like, well, geez, or a novel, you're like, God, it didn't connect. Because I thought there were so many times where he could have done it when he was at rock bottom, not at the point where he was entirely lucid and he was sober and he got his life back together. It just didn't fit for me. It was a big struggle. And as someone who works in an organization where we try and help people who are struggling with mental illness and having understanding of that, I felt a real strong disconnect to that. And I came out of that movie, I was like, oh, and I don't like having that feeling.
Yeah. know? No, I understand. And I mean, and it was a film that I very much enjoyed when I watched it, but it was really more in relation to how it, you know, connected with and sort of paid homage to the best version of A Star Is Born, which was 1954 Judy Garland. And then that one, you really understand, you really empathize with James Mason's character, the Norman Maine character, what leads him to that ultimate decision. In this one, I mean, there are moments in it as well made as Bradley Cooper's film is, there are times where you're like, well, we have to hit this story beat, you know.
Yes.
And you feel that in a lot of times in remakes where it's like, well, this happened before, so we have to connect with this now, and it just it doesn't play quite as genuinely.
Did you want to say anything, Tom?
I wanted to throw in how deep people look into editing. And it's mostly film geeks, like, and critics like myself and Matt, but if you want to see how much power goes into the art of the edit, there's a great documentary on Hulu you can watch. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's about the editing of the shower scene from Psycho.
Oh,
and
great
literally
point.
Every shot and every
yes,
edit
7852.
Is that's it.
78, because I interviewed the director. It's one of the best
Amazing.
Films about filmmaking, because it's not just about the editing of it. It's about the role that the shower scene played in the culture,
yeah.
How it really just changed.
Huh. But there's portions where they literally just
everything.
Look at it frame by frame
yeah.
by frame.
Oh.
And the effect that editing can have
yes.
on the psyche and on, as you said, as culture
yes.
is amazing.
Well, absolutely.
And I'm guessing this is also in relation to editing. Someone texted from the 847 Zodiac, David Fincher. Is that something?
So good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I mean, that's a 3-hour movie that does not feel a frame too long.
No, it just moves at a clip that is unparalleled. David Fincher's a master, and his editors are also, they work on the same wavelength as him. As Senator Katowski put it so well, where it's like, if you see bad, you know bad editing when you see it, and it can really throw you out of the story, which is just the worst part.
Yeah.
But when it's working and people are in synergy and they're making these decisions correctly, quote unquote correctly, it can make 3 hours fly by and you've just had a total experience.
Well, and I think it's two things. One, we've really, I think, struck a chord with folks on the editing part of this, but also, Senator, you also mentioned something about Stars Born and how that didn't ring true with you for the decision that Bradley Cooper makes. Mm-hmm. I felt the same way in part there, but also Bohemian Rhapsody, and you were mentioning this, that they it almost seemed like they were, and then this happened, and then we have to hit this beat.
Oh, well, that entire film is like that.
Yeah, I felt like they just like had the Wikipedia page
yes.
for Queen, and they said, "Listen, here's how Another One Bites the Dust was written, and here's how we came up with the stomping."
And
clap.
They don't even tell you. They don't even tell. It's like all of a sudden he just starts playing the melody, and like, okay, I guess we're doing this song now. Like, we don't really understand where the music comes from many cases.
The whole movie
in that film, it's very surface.
Yeah,
very generic script.
You would, if you had a problem with that moment,
and I haven't seen it,
yeah.
and I'm looking. And I'm looking forward to seeing it. I was just my friend Bill Danaher texted me. He worked on movies for years and
yeah.
wrote screenplays, and he was just saying Academy Award editors who said people had no idea what they did and the difference that they made.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, it's a shame. And I was like, well, do you think people should be recognized for what they're doing? These editors said, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is someone who worked in the movies for years.
Absolutely.
And has a passion for the movies. And he used to actually host this Academy Award night. We'd all watch the, Academy Awards, and we'd basically pick who was going to win. But he would have us all watch a classic movie. At his, at his apartment.
Oh, nice.
We all come over there, like 15, 20 of us. And
he's my kind of guy.
Yeah,
yes.
You'd love him. You'd love him.
Well, that's the thing. I feel so lucky that my son loves classic movies. We watch a lot. I mean, some of his favorite movies are Frank Capra movies, or we'll talk more about the classic movies. We're talking right now about present movies that are up for Academy Awards. We're hanging out with RogerEbert.com's associate editor.
Yes, assistant editor. Yeah,
assistant editor Matt Fagerholm joins us in studio. He also has his own website, IndieOutlook.com.
You got it.
State Senator Dan Katowski, the president of ChildServe, joins us as well for the conversation. It's your conversation too. 312-981-7200. I believe we have answered Aaron's question. More in a moment on 720 WGN. What were you going to say, Tom? February 24th is the Academy Awards, And I was torn over watching the Academy Awards or trying to get tickets to go see the Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara at the Chicago Theater.
I bought my ticket. I'm giving it to my sister for her birthday. So.
You're giving it away?
I am.
I'm going to ask the station if we have any. But there, you know, they added a show. There are two shows now. There's like a 7 o'clock and a 9 o'clock. It's still during the Academy Awards. Yeah.
Well, I actually like that they're just sticking it to the Academy, quite frankly, because Catherine O'Hara should have gotten an Oscar for Your Consideration. So that's fine.
Well, there you go.
There you go. That might actually be a conscious decision they're doing it during the Oscars. So I'm fine.
I told you about this show the other day. I cannot say the name of the show. I've been asked not to, but it's the show on that's from Canada. Eugene Levy, Dan Levy created the series, and I absolutely love it. And to the conversation about editing.
Is this one on Netflix that you told me
about? Yes, it's on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah. You watch the show?
Yes, I've watched a bit of it. Yes.
So I just noticed this the other day. They hang like an extra couple seconds longer than they need to on some of their scenes.
Yes,
and that's in the editing, and that's a creative choice.
That's often some of the biggest laughs. They're just that awkward unease, the silence. Yes, because that's what Christopher Guest does so well in Best in Show.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's great.
Yeah. So to our conversation about editing, have any of your guests ever seen Russian Ark? It's filmed in one continuous take. It's one of my son's favorites.
Yes, astonishing.
If they've seen it, yeah, there you go. They wonder what you thought of that.
And I just, any film that's done in one continuous take, how you're able to choreograph all of that. And there is editing. It's not editing in terms of cuts, but editing in terms of how long do we stay on this? When do we move here? How do we go down this hallway? And it's just all of this Russian history all encapsulated in this museum, and everyone had to hit their mark perfectly. And it's just, you just look at it, it's like a magic trick. It's unbelievable.
How long's the movie?
I think it's a couple hours.
Russian Ark.
It's a couple hours.
One continuous take.
Yeah, wow. But I saw one that's even longer. I think it was called Victoria. Let's see if Tom, I don't know if Tom's seen this, but I think it's 2.5 hours. Hmm. 2.5 hours, and they had to shoot it like 3 or 4 times. He's like, one thing went wrong, and then they had to go back and reshoot the whole 2.5 hour take. And it's a psychological thriller about this woman getting involved with these gangsters, and there's all this action, and it's all through just like one long night, starts at a club, ends in the daylight. And it's 2.5 hours. It just blows your mind they're able to do that.
And who stars in it? Anybody?
No, and there's no big name actors that people would be aware of in America. I believe it was a German film. But yeah, it was a German movie that came out a few years ago, and it just blow your mind off.
I'm going to look for that one. And then on the opposite side of that, from the 773, hey, Patty and company, it's Sean. The worst edit ever was Blade Runner's director's cut, longer but removed Harrison Ford's narration.
Oh, interesting. Yes, I know. There's many different cuts of Blade Runner. But Tom, do you have a favorite one of that? I don't know if he's listening.
It's
a different movie no matter which edit that you see of that. And the narration that he has, you know, I mean, some people don't care for the narration. Some people don't need the hard-boiled sort of old-fashioned film noir approach. But some people, you know, so it's really more of a personal preference, I think. So
that's a continuation of our conversation about editing, because the Academy has chosen to eliminate the live broadcast for four categories, including editing, cinematography, hair and makeup, and live-action shorts.
Yes.
And we are talking to Matt Fagerholm from RogerEbert.com and IndieOutlook.com, his own website, and Senator Dan Katowski hanging out with us, also now the president of ChildServe. So let's get to the nuts and bolts of some of the categories, because we're not going to see you again before the...
That's right. I'll be in the Oscar press room again for the second time, which will be interesting. Yes.
Do you come back from Los Angeles, by the way?
It'll just be the day after. I'll just get no sleep that night, be writing up my coverage, and then just taking the plane right back.
I'll let you sleep and then come back in on the Tuesday after if you want to.
Hey, I would love to come back and talk.
Absolutely. Cool. Okay, so let's go through your categories and see what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so, you know, well, I mean, if we want to start with Best Actor, I mean, I really thought this was Christian Bale's to take, but after the SAG Awards and the BAFTAs gave it to Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody, it seems like he's now the front runner in this category. And I don't know. I mean, it's a mixed feeling, because on one hand, he does a great job under the circumstance of having kind of a lousy script and bad makeup.
Yeah, but that shouldn't be the reason that you win the Academy Award.
I know, but it's becoming a sympathy thing. It really is. And I've heard some of the people like Gold Derby and other places, the prognosticators, they're saying, you know, they feel bad that he had a bad director who like chucked something at his head and, you know, got thrown off, you know, 2 weeks, you know, before the end of the shoot, and also has some allegations. I feel like that's also what's fueling some of the love for him being in the midst of this mess. And the same thing could be said of Mahershala Ali definitely winning supporting actor for Green Book, even though he's technically a co-lead in my opinion. But it's like, with all the controversy, they feel bad for Mahershala being in the midst of it, because he just gave a great performance, did what he was supposed to do as an actor. So it seems like those guys will be getting a bit of a sympathy vote, even though they also are doing great work. So
okay, so we've got the best actor category. Have you seen any like Vice or?
Oh, I saw Green Book.
Saw Green Book.
You yeah, like I, I'm trying. I'm curious what's the sympathy around him with Green Book?
It's well, the main thing is that the family of the character Don Shirley that Mahershala plays in the film were very angry with the movie because no one consulted them about it. They said it was not factually accurate to what actually happened between the two men, and it was mainly the son of the Viggo character who was really kind of spearheading the film. So they're saying it's a one-sided movie, and it's interesting. My big problem with the movie is that it's more about the Viggo character than the Mahershala character, and Mahershala is that it really feels it's more his story. It's called Green Book. It's about this guy going to the South, making the statement, "I'm going to be performing this music for these audiences." I feel like it is kind of whenever he was on the screen, if like there's the movie, you know. And I mean, and I liked it. It's a good film, but it's more like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in the end than like the subversive film it could have been.
A little road trip.
Something interesting happens though in that film, and I think there's a change for both of them at the end.
There is,
as a consequence of their friendship. So
there's a change, and then it's also a change of the family perhaps being more accepting. You know, the extended family that's just more casual and how they talk about people and everything. So I mean, it's there's an arc. I just feel like it was more Mahershala's film.
All right, so best actor, and then so for best actress or best woman and a female in a lead.
Oh, best actress is definitely Glenn Close. She's getting it because she'll be the losingest actor or actress.
But really?
Yes, like because she's been nominated 6 times, hasn't won. This is her 7th nomination. This will be her time, and she's great in the film. So I couldn't be happier for her.
And that's for The Wife, by the way.
That's film called The Wife.
Not a very big film. A lot of people haven't seen it.
A lot of people haven't seen it. If more people saw it, then Jonathan Pryce, who plays her husband, would definitely be up for supporting actor this year. But unfortunately, no.
It's what I do like about the Academy Awards is the comfort level of just doing the same thing every single year. You have the best supporting actor presented by last year's supporting actress. So who do you think is going to win for best supporting actor, which is going to be the first award of the evening?
Oh, supporting actor? Yeah. Oh, definitely Mahershala Ali for Green Book. And he's great. I mean, I'm not going to complain. I mean, I'd love to see Sam Elliott get it for A Star Is Born. Because I think that's a true supporting performance. I think he just... I thought he was the most impressive actor in that movie.
And then for the actress?
Oh, supporting actress will have to be Regina King for If Beale Street Could Talk. I think that will be the one award that is guaranteed for that Barry Jenkins film that was so beautiful. I think it's so much better than a lot of the Best Picture nominees, but I'm very happy for Regina.
All right. Now, have you seen many of the movies? Because I haven't seen a lot of the movies this year.
I've seen about half of them.
Half of them?
And I think we're going to see a bunch of them on Saturday.
Are you going to do a marathon of?
Well, yeah.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, they're going to be doing that, making them available at the theater.
We're just going to go see as many as we can in anticipation.
Are you sneaking into movies, sir?
No. Not that you know of. But we're going to do our best to see them. I'm excited about these movies, and I'm excited about the fact that it's like I kind of feel like it's in many respects we're kind of in the golden age of not just television but also like movies, like because you have so many more options for what you get a chance to see,
more streaming platforms, more different ways of accessing.
All due respect to the history of movies, but there are so many the menu is greater, and that doesn't necessarily translate into a better product. But now I was like, there are when you go to a movie. I mean, even just watching like a show on Netflix, I'm like, oh my god, this is could be an outstanding movie.
Absolutely,
like the one with John Goodman, the Black Earth Rising.
I've been hearing about that.
Absolutely phenomenal.
I watched half of A Russian Doll on Netflix. That was wonderful. I've seen so far. There's some really cinematic television out there.
Yeah, and I think so. I'm looking forward to seeing Vice. So what was your view? How did think Christian Bale did in that?
I mean, he's astonishing. I would give him the Oscar this year if I could, but
you would.
I mean, it was Daniel Day-Lewis level immersion into that character, and that was the greatness of that film, was his performance, just as Rami Malek's was the greatness of Bohemian Rhapsody. And I want Spike Lee to win Best Director.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back.
Well, I will.
312-981-7200. We are hanging out in the Allstate Skyline Studio with Matt Fagerhelm, who works for RogerEbert.com, associate editor. He also has his own website, IndieOutlook.com. State Senator Dan Katowski hanging out with us, and he's going to catch up on all. I haven't seen a lot of these movies either. So I'm excited for Roma. So let's see what we all think when we come back on 720 WGN. What do you think? 312-981-7200. You can call or text us to that number. We want to know why RogerEbert.com's Matt Fagerholm wants Spike Lee to win Best Director for this year's Academy Awards, which will be airing on February 24th. Joining us in the studio as well is State Senator Dan Katowski. You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200 is the number to call or text us. By the way, Tom Hush producing the show tonight, and we have Vic Vaughn at the news desk. So go ahead, Matt, tell us, make the case for why Spike Lee should win the Academy Award this year.
Well, it's a great category anyway this year. I mean, for Black Klansman, it would be with Spike Lee. But, I mean, Pavel Pavlikovsky, Cold War, Yorgos Lanthimos, The Favorite, Alfonso, obviously I think he's going to win for Roma. I mean, you really can't go wrong. Except Adam McKay Vice, that's fine. I don't know. That's the one weak link, personally. It should be a woman in his place. It should be Deborah Granik for Leave No Trace. That's who should be for director. But Spike Lee, a black director, has never won in this category ever. Even Whoa. When Moonlight won, even when 12 Years a Slave won for Best Picture, they did not win Best Director. But it's not just for like a political, social reason. It's a great, Black Klansman is his best narrative feature since 25th Hour back in the day. I think that was like 2002. And it's one of his most important. It takes this historical moment, you know, the 70s, this black cop infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan very cleverly, brilliantly. So much of the real things that happen in the movie, you right. know, so which makes it better than Green Book for me, in my opinion. But then it takes that and puts it right into reality, right into now, right? And there's an immediacy to the film that is not, it doesn't feel safe. It doesn't play safe with history like Green Book does or The Help does, or yeah, I could just go on and on about that. It's like, it's not a film you can easily dismiss and feel good about.
I have to
It
agree.
Doesn't let you sleep.
I enjoyed well. It. I enjoyed it a lot. I think you'll enjoy it, Senator, when you see the movie. Yeah. That's one of the ones that has to be on your list before the awards. Yeah.
And I would just love for him to win. I would love to see what that acceptance speech would be. There's just so much about that that would make me very happy.
Yeah, so, it would be monumental.
Absolutely.
Yeah, historic.
Absolutely.
All right, so that's for Best Director. So then, though, for Best Picture, do you think it's Black Klansman or Roma, which a lot of people think is going
to
win?
I don't know. I'm starting to think less and less that Black Klansman will probably win this category. I would hate to see. This is the thing. When we talk about editing, okay, let's see what's up for editing. We go over here. I mean, because it's really important. I mean, the editing really counts in terms of what wins this. So Black Klansman's up for editing. Bohemian Rhapsody, Green Book, The Favorite, Vice. This is the chance for one of those Golden Globe Best Picture winners, Bohemian Rhapsody or Green Book, to win picture. If it wins editing, it might win picture. So I don't know. I mean, that it's really kind of totally open. I mean, Green Book won the PGA, the Producers Guild Award for Best Picture. So it could have that, you know, if it wins editing, it'll have a much better chance of winning picture. So it's something that's sort of during the telecast you'll be most, you know, aware of. But Roma should win. Roma should win.
I love Matt's the sort of train of thought that we get to.
I'm just trying to take you through the process.
And there's some really good animated films this year as well.
Yes.
I know a lot of people love Spider-Man in the Spider-Verse.
Right? Yes. Well, and that's going to win, even though I actually have a bet with one of my friends, but I never make Oscar bets. He's like, there's no way they're going to give an Oscar to a Marvel superhero movie. But I think this is better than any of the Marvel Cinematic Universe films, and not just in terms of its inclusivity, but it's a brilliant animated film. I've never seen animation like this. The mixture of styles, the writing is just as ambitious and as fascinating as the visual just composition. I mean, they really just knocked it out of the park with this movie. So I think this will be the first major Marvel Oscar win.
Wow, and not Wes Anderson. People love them some Wes Anderson.
I love Wes Anderson. I love Isle of Dogs. That would have been the front runner. And I feel like he's got to get his eventually. Right. I don't know. I mean, I wished he had won for Moonrise Kingdom personally for me. So
now now what do you think about, because the screenplays are also part of the Academy Awards, and I love seeing who wins those. So there are two categories. There's original screenplay and adapted screenplay.
Yeah. This blows my mind. If we want to go into original screenplay, Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, mm-hmm. Last Temptation of Christ, so many of the best, he's never been nominated for an Oscar.
Are you kidding?
Never been nominated. This is his first nomination for First Reformed. I would love to see him win. I mean, First Reformed is up for nothing else. Ethan Hawke should be up for actor. It should be up for picture. I know, but that's the thing. Not enough people probably saw it. But I mean, it's one of the year's very, very best films. I hope he wins, but he probably won't. I think that will probably go to, I don't know, Green Book. I mean, I guess Green Book has to get something right, or The Favorite, maybe. I mean, I think one of those two will probably take that home. And then adapted screenplay, this is what might happen, sadly. I mean, not sadly. I mean, this could be Spike Lee's first Oscar win for adapted screenplay. And I used to think it was going to be Barry Jenkins for Beale Street, but that got snubbed in the picture category. So I think this might be Spike Lee's Oscar win. It'll be an adapted screenplay instead of director.
Well, I've covered a lot of ground. Before we go to the break, I want to say hi to our friend Trucker Jamie, who says he's pulling us in. He can hear us in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and he's got chocolate-covered strawberries to give for Valentine's Day.
Oh, that sounds so delicious.
Great to hear from you, Jamie. More in a moment on 720 WGN. It is now past midnight, which means that it's Wednesday. I'm one of those people that if I haven't gone to bed yet, it's not the next day. So how do you rate the days? I mean, Matt Fager.
Oh, it is still Tuesday.
It's still Tuesday. Is it Tuesday or Wednesday?
It's totally Tuesday. I'm still there.
Well, there have been nights where we'll schedule somebody because my show starts on, like we just did, you started on Tuesday, now you've gone into Wednesday, but there are some guests that we book for like midnight. I've now gotten into the habit of making sure that they know midnight, and I'll say, you know, Tuesday night, but technically going into Wednesday morning, so that we've had people show up on the wrong nights.
Will you do an email? Like, I'll send, oftentimes, I get motivated to do work about 2 a.m, and I'll start sending emails out, and then I'll say, well, I'll see you tomorrow, and it's at 2 a.m.
Right. So when they get it, it's going to be 8 or 9 in the morning.
They're like, what are you talking about tomorrow? You mean tomorrow?
Right.
From...
Yeah.
No.
I do the same thing. Yes. Yes.
That's why we get along.
I try to be day sensitive.
Yes.
I guess.
Do you think that when did this vampire stuff start? Did it start
for
in
me?
College? Yeah.
No, I actually loved being up late even when I was a kid. I would say, you know, one of Johnny Carson.
Oh,
part
sure.
of it was staying up late to watch Johnny Carson.
For me now, it's Turner Classic Movies. You turn that on, I'll never go to sleep.
Yeah. For me, it was Kolchak, The Night Stalker with Darren McGavin.
Oh, we just watched a few episodes of that. Remember the one with the mannequins?
Totally.
That came to life.
It's great. Oh. Did you watch the show?
I've never seen it. Is that on MeTV?
I think you might be able to watch it on Amazon. You might have to buy it, though.
Potentially. But, you know, Darren McGavin, good. You saw him in The Natural, right?
Yes, yes.
And so he's been in any number, but he was outstanding. And then my father,
so good.
You couldn't stay up late, but if it was horror-related,
yeah.
he would let you stay up late. Or Monty Python, which was like...
my right? dad, too.
Yeah, you're like, well, you know, my dad said he'd be a priest. And, you know, and then he, you know, whatever. He met my mom and 5 kids. But, like, there were certain things. You can't have bad language. You can't have this and that. But we can watch Monty Python.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can watch anything that's going to scare the heck out of you.
Monty Python, The Holy Grail, was the most quoted film in my high school. Just right. That was... Everyone knew every word of that script. So it's timeless comedy.
My dad also let me stay up late to watch Doctor Who used to be on Sunday nights on PBS.
Oh, yes. We watched Doctor Who. Too.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, still going strong.
Yes. My dad loved the horror stuff too. That was that's a great show.
Creature feature.
Oh, all that.
Yeah, my dad watched Creature Features. Yeah. Yeah. I still love him. Bride of Frankenstein. Represent. It's great.
Speaking of which, by the way, before it closes, since you like scary stuff, The Woman in Black at the Royal George Theater is incredible play.
I've heard it's amazing.
It
really?
Yes.
It's so good. It closes this Sunday, so you only have a few days. Allie, come on in. Allie Clayton joins us in studio. She was performing at Zany's this week, and I wanted to get a hold of her before she leaves town because she left us for New York not too long ago. Although, I mean, you know, it's good to have you back. Hi, Allie.
Hi. What a nice time of year to come back.
I'm so sorry.
You love trudging through the slush out there. It's fantastic.
This isn't even as bad as it's been. Have people told you that yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been brutal. This has been, really, really hard. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good.
How are you liking New York?
It took a while.
It took a bit of a time.
Chicago's big, but it's still Midwestern friendly.
Well, now, let people know where you grew up.
North Carolina.
Okay. So how was the transition from North Carolina to Chicago first?
Grey's Anatomy was my best friend.
Aww.
I used to get all the DVDs at Blockbuster. and those doctors were the only people I talked to for about a year. But then, I mean, you get into the comedy scene, and then, you know.
And you were working, I was just telling the senator and Matt off the air that I met you because you were a caregiver for a young man named Bradley and who you are still friends with and hanging
that's
out with this weekend.
That's why I'm here. It's his 31st birthday.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
How old was he when you started working with Bradley?
21. It's been exactly 10 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's wonderful. And he's such a great guy. Just so much fun to be around.
He asked, could he FaceTime you today? I was like, I think she's...
Oh, I would have done that. Let me know. Well, and if you want to do it while you guys are traveling, just let me know.
Okay. Well, we're going to Great Wolf Lodge tomorrow.
I was excited when you said that because that's our favorite water park.
I love that place. I'm like, we're going to have no kids. They're going to be like, who are these drunk adults? Which is fine. I think.
Yeah, that's place it. To yourselves. Whatever. That's ideal.
Yeah, I agree. So from Chicago to New York then, the comedy scene a little bit different. Yeah. I don't think competitive is quite the right word, is it? Would you say competitive or caustic? I don't know.
There's not as much of a... that's a lot.
Community.
Like, it's a community. Like, more cutthroat.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's even more cutthroat when you're walking through New York. My sister lived there for years, and she loved it, and she moved back here. But it's a different speed limit that you're walking at in the city.
Do you think about just making the switch to L.A. then? At least it's warmer.
I went recently for my first time. I did stand-up NBC, and I got to go out there, and I thought I was not going to like it.
Uh-huh.
But...
yeah,
I like sunshine.
Yeah, yeah. I don't blame you. It's much nicer out there. Well, actually, there's a story I want to share. So, and this actually might work because I have cried in public. I'm trying to think of the last time I cried. I remember.
That's fully accepted in New York.
Is it really?
People do that.
Do
all
they
the
pay
time.
Attention to you?
No, nobody cares.
They don't care, right?
Nobody cares.
Tom, will you do me a favor? Tom, if you get, let's see if we can find the list because there's a list of the best places in Chicago to cry in public.
Oh.
So, and I think that the list has also been made for New York, Boston, San Francisco, D.C., Philly.
Who's making these lists?
By curbed.com. So I'm going to see if, hey, Tom, do you happen to know if you can find the list for crying in public for New York so we can share that with Allie too?
The answer is knowledge. Everywhere.
Everywhere? Yeah. That's what she said.
Really?
She said everywhere. So you lived in Chicago. What neighborhood were you living in when you did comedy here?
I stayed at one apartment for 5 years in Lincoln Square.
Oh, I love Lincoln Square.
Mm. Oh, my God. I had a backyard with an apple
backyard?
Tree.
Backyard? Oh,
an apple tree and a pear tree. It was like,
oh, my God.
Mayberry on the north side.
That's amazing. That's so nice. You have to leave. You got a full meal right there. It's amazing.
That is, and where did you live after that?
And then I went to New York, Forest Hills, mm-hmm. which is like kosher Jewish.
Okay.
I did not know this. So like if I would like walk out in like a tank top, all these women would just like the devil.
And so it's Orthodox.
Yeah, yes. Very, yeah. So nobody wanted to chat in the neighborhood. But now I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Tank top, let your tank top freak fly.
Yeah. So now I'm a gentrifier.
I know.
I tell them, but I have a brown girlfriend, so I just like wave her around.
That helps a lot.
Yeah.
She helps you navigate the streets. I'm trying to remember. So these are some of the places that they say it's good to cry in public. So 312-981-7200, if you have some place that you feel comfortable crying in public, I think a lot of people, it's not public, but it's kind of is bathroom stalls at work. I feel like there's a lot of crying. Maybe not in the, men don't cry, do they? You're looking at me like
I'm
crazy.
I haven't heard many in the bathroom stalls crying or other type of noises, but...
There are only two times that a man is allowed to cry.
Yes.
During the national anthem.
Oh, really?
And at the end of Old Yeller.
I thought it was the end of...
two things, like... What,
I thought it was the end of Field of Dreams was the other one.
No,
that's one where you get close. You're like choking up a little bit, but then you don't actually cry. And then you look at your son, and you're just like, I love you, boy. Yeah.
I went to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's It's a Wonderful Life screening, and I was coming out in buckets.
I was dying. I was shaking.
It's ridiculous. But everyone was in my row. Everyone was crying.
Yeah, and my wife was next. She's like, are you all right? No, I just let it out. It's a Wonderful Life, definitely. Just
yes.
Let the tears flow.
I mean, come on. I don't care.
I haven't watched
Curb
Old Yeller.
Says.
I don't know.
I've never seen
it.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Old Yeller?
Oh, it's a masterpiece.
No, but I used to love Where the Red Fern Grows.
Yes, another great crying dog movie, definitely.
I've never heard.
There were some Super Bowl commercials that really got me this year.
Really?
But the Microsoft commercial was really good.
Oh,
the kids.
I don't remember anything from this year.
When they play Everybody Wins, right? It's about the kids having access to games and they can.
Yeah.
All
all abilities. And the other one was the girls, the female athlete commercial really got me too.
That's really good.
Okay, so there were some touching ones.
Yes.
The first responders one, what I thought was a really good one
too,
for Verizon.
Yeah.
And I was watching a Dateline marathon.
I wish I was watching that instead.
I'm all murders and comedy.
It was a terrible game, terrible halftime show. Gladys Knight was the best thing about the game.
She was really good, Allie.
Well, I saw Adam Levine, and that really just blew home how gay I am. Because I was just like, please stop. Please. This is horrible.
I had seen him in concert a couple weeks beforehand.
Did he wear clothes?
Yes.
He was wearing a tank top.
It wasn't a naked performance. And so, but there was a group of people. It was for Governor Pritzker's the party afterwards, after he had been sworn in, and I was there, and there was a group of women, and that were all watching the stage, and they were transfixed, and I'm like, what are they so transfixed by? And they were just staring at Adam Levine, and I thought, well, even though I'm I'm 51 and I'm bald, but I still got it going. But no one was looking at me. Right?
Allie, do you go to concerts at all?
Concerts?
See, I haven't been to a concert. There's not anybody I would go stand in front of the stage and yell at.
Somebody you would stare at?
I went to Darius Rucker over the summer. And I love some Hootie and the Blowfish. So
when
he started playing the old tunes, I really lost it.
Did you? So is there would Darius Rucker, would he make you,
We consider being gay?
No.
No, I think so. I'm just curious.
I'm not sure where you're going with that question.
I don't know.
I enjoyed it, though.
I let you. It was a dot, dot, dot. It was an ellipses question.
Well, I would I'll just say this on record. I would definitely date Gladys Knight. So
there you go.
Yes. I would not be out of my range.
She was phenomenal. All right. 312-981-7200. Let me find some places to cry. Just maybe in the hallway. We're back at 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, and joining us in the studio is Allie Clayton. She's in town just a little bit. She's visiting us from New York. She headlined at Zany's this week. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Come back and do that. And I saw some great photos. You had to have fun that night.
Rena Calm.
Yeah.
My pageant mom, comedy mom.
We also have in studio Matt Fagerholm. He is associate editor at RogerEbert.com, and IndieOutlook.com is his website as well.
I want to see this pageant mother thing. That sounds great.
Rena
Calm. Sounds wonderful. Great material. Yeah.
And State Senator Dan Katowski joins us as well. He's now the president of ChildServe. And Matt just said something off the air that I have to second. I like visiting New York. Actually, I don't even know if I like it that much. but I could never. I remember being there one time and just thinking, is there any sunshine here? Because the buildings are so... and I...
See, I'm usually indoors seeing a play. I saw a play with Michael Cera and it was incredible. I don't know. But I guess it all depends on what you do during your allotted time there. So.
Well, living there, and the comedy clubs, it is different. And I think it pushes you in ways that maybe you don't have here as well.
I mean, that was my reason for choosing there because... you get to a point in Chicago where there's not enough industry, really, and it's making that choice, which coast am I going to go to? And I just felt like the comedy I saw coming out of New York was of higher caliber.
Right.
I was like, it's going to be really hard, but it's going to push me to be better.
Right. And there's an authenticity, I think, to comics in New York that you don't necessarily get. I mean, Chicago you do, but there is a comfort level that we have here, I think.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily have to push ourselves because industry might be in the room, right, as you do in Los Angeles and New York.
Interesting.
And that competitiveness. And it's a different type of storytelling, too, and it changes your rhythm, too, I think, to always be thinking of, is this going to be my 6 or 7 minute set for Conan or for Fallon or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah. I saw a great film about this. I don't know if either of you have thoughts on this. Don't Think Twice, the Mike Birbiglia film about comedians in New York. Did either of you see that or know if that has much truth in that? Because it was about that sort of environment where one gets picked to go on Saturday Night Live and immediately gets very streamlined and the competitive breakneck nature of the whole thing. Just
kind of
fascinating.
The end of my hour right now, a big 15-minute chunk is me telling the story of being booed off the Apollo, which happened to me 3 years into comedy. Gladys Knight was a judge.
What? Oh, no! Well, I take that back about
it. No.
So did you ever go back, or did you... Well, the Apollo
is brutal. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, it was because none of the cool white dudes on the north side would give me time of day when I started in 2009 in Chicago. So I went over to the south side as a little hillbilly, not knowing there was a difference in the north side and the south side.
Oh, wow.
And then I just started hanging out on 47 Martin Luther King Drive with all these black comics. And they embraced me so much, and they invited me to this BET audition, and I went. And I actually got it, and I thought, like, this is my big break. But I was being given a diversity scholarship to be booed.
I was
the diverse one in that situation.
To have you like a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Interesting. And was it at the? So it was at the Apollo in New York.
Yeah, and I forgot to rub the stump, which is real disrespectful.
This
is the one I think I've done a lot of research on the stump. So there was this tree called the Tree of Hope in Harlem, and this was considered like a lucky charm in the black community. And in 1934, the tree was chopped down, and they took the stump of it, got it shellacked, placed it on top of a golden pillar, and placed it on the right-hand side of stage of the Apollo for any act that came to rub it as a good luck charm. And so Michael Jackson, Beyonce, all these people have rubbed this stump. When you enter the stage, you rub the stump. And I was so nervous I didn't rub the stump. So they started to boo.
Even before you started?
Yeah. Oh,
gosh.
So
they didn't even give you a chance, really.
Well, then they had to cut the camera, and they said, Allie forgot to rub the stump. We have to take it again.
Oh, come on.
So then I had to go off stage and come back on again. And I panicked.
That's intense.
And I humped the stump.
No, you didn't.
I panic humped the stump, and it didn't go well.
What? That's great.
Hey, at least it rhymes, you know.
Yeah, most humbling moment of my life.
How far into your set did you make it before he came out and grabbed you and took you off the stage?
Oh, you mean when the Sandman tap danced with a broom?
Yes.
to sweep me off?
Yes.
It was not funny for a long time. It's funny now. I had this thing where I would kick out my punchlines for like my first 4 years of comedy.
What do you mean by kick out?
Like with my cowboy boots, like, I like to kick out my punchlines. If you want to know if something's funny, look for a kick. Bam! And kick. And so the producers say, look, we want you to just come out kicking. We love your kick. And I was like, okay, give them no context at all. Just come out kicking. Sure, no problem. I'll do that.
Kind of like a Russian dancer. Just
so I humped the stump, kicked my way to center, and looked at Gladys Knight and said, I like to kick out my punchlines. You know what I'm saying, Gladys Knight? And she didn't.
Nothing.
She didn't know what I was saying.
Oh, no. Wow. All right. So when does the Sandman come out with the broom?
About, I'd say 5 seconds after that.
Really? So you didn't even get in there?
Oh, so they didn't really give you a fair shot.
This is so painful. I know what you mean, though. It wasn't funny for a long time, right? I mean, like, when you came home after that, like, how long were you in bed for, would you say? Did you stay in bed? Because I would have stayed in bed. I mean, I had weeks like that.
I think I would have. I think, except for I had to be there at 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. that morning. And it was probably around 9:05 when I realized this maybe wasn't going to go so well.
Right.
I talked to a security guard there, and he told me, you know, people come here every week just to boo.
Right, right.
And I was like, really? And he was like, you got bigger balls than me. So I was like, oh.
Well, that's something.
Yeah.
I was curious because I was going to ask, what's the difference between the New York audience and Chicago audience? That's an example, like, on the extreme,
well, that's,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, in general, what's it like now in terms of when you're doing comedy?
Different from, like, if you're doing a bar show to if you're doing a club.
Right.
Which I think is the same here, kind of. Like,
but is it edgier, or is it?
Shows are more edgy.
But
and,
I think New York audiences are edgier in general. I think that they have a lower tolerance.
Well, it depends, because sometimes, you know, if I'm doing a 7 o'clock show at Stand Up New York on a Saturday, that could just be all tourist.
Right. Oh. So it's not so bad.
Or is it bad? I mean, they're there, they're excited. You know, they're all like, when's the star going to come in? When's the star going to come in? I'm like, just me. From the Apollo.
Allie Clayton. But it's not, but here's the thing. The great thing about the name Allie Clayton, it really sounds famous. It does. Yes.
It's a great
name. It does.
Name.
It is a great name.
Thank you.
Yeah. We are hanging out with Allie Clayton. You know her. She's right here. We are hanging out with State Senator Dan Katowski. You might know him.
No.
And we love Matt Fagerholt. We love all of you.
But I know
you'll not know
me. I know Allie Clayton now. So.
Now you know Allie. Right.
She's the sequel to Michael Clayton. It's great. Right. He's sitting right here.
More in a moment. We're going to take a break and then the news on 720 WGN. All over the world, there are thrift stores that are begging people to stop Marie Kondoing their houses. People are showing up with garbage bags filled with crap that they don't want in their house anymore. And I'm wondering if anybody's having a... But I think there are ways to actually have fun with it, and I didn't realize that until today. Allie Clayton, I asked if you have done... You said you've done one Marie Kondo drawer?
Yeah, I've done...
The folding?
I feel like me and my girlfriend are getting kind of like aggressive towards each other of like... I don't want to have this in our tiny, tiny apartment. Does it bring you joy? Does this bring you joy? It's not bringing me joy.
Like, do you talk to your clothing? Do you thank it? Do you thank it for its service? That's the weird thing.
So we were on the floor, like, trying to do it, and, like, I was kind of holding and hugging, and I was like, I feel like, and I just looked at her, I was like, I feel like an idiot.
Yeah. I feel very silly about it.
I feel very silly about this.
Allie Clayton's in town. She performed this week at Zany's, and she's heading out for a little bit of a trip to, you know, hang out with Bradley, so we're excited for you guys. Matt Fagerholt is in studio. He leaves next week for the Academy Awards, covering it for RogerEbert.com.
Yeah.
And his own, are you covering it as well for IndieOutlook.com?
I think it's mainly for the Ebert site. And I'm going to storm the stage and hand out the Cinematography Award live. That's what I'm going to do.
I think that's a
and
really
editing,
good idea.
And editing.
I
yeah.
like that. Yeah. And State Senator Dan Katowski joins us. He's the president of ChildServe. You can go to childserve.org for information on how you can help out, especially this time of year when Christmas is over. People kind of stop, you know, looking for places to donate to. And you can always use volunteers and donations and want to, you know, find out where people can help.
Absolutely. We had 10 bikes donated.
You're going to get three more from my garage alone.
Yeah. It's really helpful. People are always... The great news about like our country and our state and our city, people are always figuring out a way to be kind in general, and especially when it comes to kids and families who need help, that people step up. And it's I'm blessed to be a part of this organization, the Child Service.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you left the Senate in part to do different work, but also to spend more time with your family. Which I'm more acutely aware now on how defensive I am with my time.
Totally.
No, because that Griffin's going to leave home in 3.5 years. I mean, he was just talking about how he wants to. We're probably going to go to Boston this summer to see if he likes that. To see if he wants to go to Harvard or MIT.
I'm pretty sure he can get in now. Like, I
know.
See the things you posted about him.
Honestly, Allie, I mean, I he blows me away, and I agree. I asked Steve the other day. I think I was like, do you think we should just like let him try it out, see if he can like get in, because he seems to be just done.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he, you know, he still needs to grow, and but yeah, he's incredibly, you've met him, he's incredibly smart. And well, you know, he was
his parents are really smart too.
He watches C-SPAN, like that's his background noise while he's doing homework. I'm not kidding. Like, I can't.
Does he have a favorite subject? Favorite.
But the nice thing about C-SPAN. As far as like,
oh, you're just in general, yeah.
No, he does everything. He's on the math team. He's on the debate team. He's unfortunately he needs to speak more slowly. I don't know where he gets that from. I don't know why he talks so quickly. It's like he has so many ideas in his head. He has to get them all out.
I've had that same problem.
So I've got to teach him to slow down and take a breath.
He'll just be the next Scorsese. It's fine. It'll be fine.
I think that works. So he was doing his homework watching John Dingell's funeral today. I'm not kidding you. That's what he was doing his homework to. And Steve and I were in the kitchen, and I decided, like, we have a pretty small pantry, and we have a lot of stuff. Like, Steve buys the entire snack aisle trying to figure out what the boys will eat, like, you know, turkey jerky and, you know, figs and dried dates and all these different things. But we also have these shelves that are hard to get to. So I'm like, I'm going to clear out this space right now. He was doing the dishes. And it was kind of this weird trip down memory lane, because we had like these souvenir cups from the rainforest. You never been to the Rainforest Cafe?
Yes.
It's a weird place.
It is, but
animatronic animals ruining your digestion. It's great.
Well, and you know, at Woodfield Mall, they have taken away the fish. They don't have the aquariums anymore. They have the aquariums, but they're just empty. It's just bubbles now.
Well, that's real sad.
It is very sad. But I remember.
But the good news is they have great goldfish to eat there.
Oh,
Sorry.
All I remember is I had an awkward date there, and there was just this elephant just every 20 minutes and just made it even worse.
Matt.
Just, it's not a good place to have a date.
You took a date there?
No, they took me. They insisted. They insisted. Yes.
Matt, never go. Never go. See, like that.
It really should just be a sketch. I know. It
what?
Yes.
Yeah. Even more intense. And then all of a sudden there's lightning and thunder.
It's true. Yeah. It's the worst place to take a date. Never take a date.
That is so funny. So what was great was I would go out to the living room because we had all these souvenir cups. I'm like, do you want any of these cups? Some are from Lincoln Park Zoo. Some are from Brookfield. These are from Pump It Up, the Jump Zone. Those right? Mm-hmm. All those different places. And then I found these wine glasses at some point. Steve and I had decided, well, now that we have kids, we should have these big plastic wine. They're just plastic wine glasses with the stem and everything. And I handed him one. And he goes, no, these are great because if we just, you know, if we drop one, you know, and he drops it and the thing just shatters all over.
It's the best punchline. I love that stuff.
I was like, oh,
loving that happened.
I go, no, that's a really good point. We should totally. So because we had a matching set, I'm like, no, let me go show Griffin your point. So of course I go out to show Griffin daddy's little story about how we should keep these plastic wine glasses, and I drop it, nothing happens to it. And he goes, good story, mom. And I pick it up again. I'm like, no, this will break. I'm like, yeah, I shattered it after good. Two or three tries. So, but that's one way to get rid of some stuff in your,
so that glass doesn't bring you joy anymore.
It does not bring me joy. Yeah. It didn't bring me. And the other thing is, you know, when you leave things in a cupboard behind the fridge for a long time, and I believe our chef, our Iron Chef Judge Mario Rosati mentioned this earlier, behind the fridge gets a little hot back there.
Mm-hmm. It does get a little hot. And, it's so not good for the oil.
Somehow the oil, I don't know if it came out of the olive oil bottle and onto my glassware, but everything was coated in this layer of oil and dust. No. Yeah. So there was a lot of cleaning in that space.
Did you feel freer?
I do.
Yes.
Well, and the other thing is how long, I mean, like I had stuff going back to like 2004. I had teas and red beans that I never made, lentils and rice, and they were all still in the bag. Yeah, I felt.
There's just so much we don't need, and there's so much we just usually just don't have time just to rummage through on a daily basis.
There's only so many boxes of Gypsy Cold that you need, I think. Right?
It was a 6-month process for me, literally, after reading that book. It took 6 months. And I sorted through everything, all the paperwork that I had from when I was in the Senate, and I sorted out into, you know, I condensed it into a bin. And I put all these files together. And it took me several months. I had like mountains of papers that I had to sift through. And it was just, that book was life changing.
So you
for
read
me.
The book. You were like even before this whole Netflix wave.
I did. And you wouldn't think, like, if you had met me, like, years when I first met my wife, we started dating in September, and I had a Christmas tree that was up from the previous December, from 10 months before. And she's like, really? Are you celebrating Christmas now? I'm like, no, that's from last December. And I had a whole stacks of letters, but it was transformative just to go through that, because now when you purge, it's like every couple of months you realize, oh, this is getting a little out of hand. But it literally was a 6-month process.
I will say, like you said, Allie, I've done a couple of drawers, and it does, and now it's hard for me to just leave things on chairs.
Folding, yes. The folding method though, that really does help.
It does.
The organization.
Yeah. I do.
Really what does. Is that exactly? I don't. I need to read.
Well, it's there are many videos on YouTube that you can look. But for shirts, you basically fold it. I don't know how to explain it. And
into three quarters. Basically, it's going to stand upright so that when you pull out your drawer, you can see each individual shirt.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Instead of having to like lift them up and go through it.
Oh, yeah, nice.
I didn't do that. That was just too much. Like
just the papers.
It was papers and clothes. It was papers and clothes and
purging.
But that's a whole other level. That's great. Like and actually sorting things out by color in the closet was like, are you kidding me? And my wife was like, who are you?
I'm an emotional hoarder. Like anything Bradley's ever done.
Yes. Yes.
Mm. I'm like, well, he scribbled this note for me.
Well, and that's the thing too, is we've been trying to take pictures of things that we like, but not enough to display it. Mm-hmm. Right, so at least we have the memory, but that's not quite the same as like something that
some things you wanted.
My grandmother was obsessed with Clay Aiken, and after she passed, I found like we're from North Carolina, where he's from, every newspaper article that ever came out about Clay Aiken.
Oh,
she had clipped, and I kept all of them.
I could see why.
I was an usher at the Chicago Theater, and he came in with a play where he was the star, but people from his hometown were the whole ensemble around him, I remember. It was crazy. It was like this Christmas play, and he would come in and pause the action. Everyone would stand there, and he'd sing a song, and they'd like, okay, unpause, and then everyone would go about the play. It was the craziest thing. There was people from his hometown that he'd bring on tour going to different places.
That's really cool.
And those were the most just like hyper fans at that
The Clay Aiken?
Clay Aiken.
Him and Ruben Studdard, the Velvet Teddy Bear. I don't know if you guys are American Idol fans. They did a Broadway show, and I wanted to go real bad. A roommate in New York actually went on a couple dates with Clay Aiken.
Cool.
And,
oh, really?
And I'm like, make this work for me.
I know you're getting something.
Your roommate went on a couple dates with Clay Aiken?
Yeah.
Didn't he also do like a Joseph Technicolor Dreamcoat?
Yeah.
Okay, so no, we're thinking the same guy. Yeah.
How old is Clay Aiken?
Well, let's see. My roommate is 33. I'm 32. And then I think he's probably like 36.
Okay.
37. Yeah.
That's a little old.
He sounds like he's much older than even Clay Aiken, doesn't he?
I don't know.
No, why are you shaking your head?
He's 40, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, he's ancient.
He's around there. Wikipedia never lies.
Well, that was the thing too. We found some candles in the birthday candles in the pantry, and I was like, who are these going to be for? Because it's like it's a 1 in 4, and he goes, well, you'll be 41 someday, and I keep lying about my age.
No. And it's still like on cake on it, right?
He goes, how old are you now? Because, well, how old are you telling people? I'm like, I don't tell anybody how old I am.
I didn't realize it about you.
You don't know I don't tell people how old I am? No, I don't tell anybody.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's not like, does it ever come up?
Mm-mm.
I mean,
you know, actually, I'm donating my hair soon. I'm cutting off 10 inches of my hair.
Oh.
And,
So how short is it going to be? I can imagine you with like...
You, just to the cloud.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's pretty long. Yeah, like how weird. That goes well on the radio. It's about this long. But someone was like, well, you know, you can't donate hair that's colored. And I said, I know. My hair's not colored. I've never colored my hair.
Did somebody really say that? You can't donate hair that's colored?
You can't. I tried.
Really?
No, but then
even once?
The assumption that it's colored. That
For me?
Know.
Yeah. No, you know who couldn't believe that I didn't color my hair is Audrey Jonas. She's really sweet, and she was. And I don't know if she has meant. I try to take it as she loves the color of my hair, not that I'm too old to not have never covered my hair. But friends of mine from grade school won't believe that this is my. Yeah, so I'm very excited about that. I'm like, I wish I'd done it more often. I wish I'd.
Why does it make your hair invalid somehow?
The chemicals of it especially because my hair is such dark. It's a dark brown.
Yeah.
In order to color it, to lighten it, you would have to strip it and then add color to it. So then there's no way for them to match that to mix it into wigs.
Is it for cancer patients?
Yes.
Great.
So I think I'm trying to figure out, we're going to do a video of it, but I have to figure out, I just want people to feel comfortable doing it and encourage them to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
You should grow yours out, sir.
I would. I would if it was possible, but thanks for the encouragement.
When did you decide to start shaving?
My head?
Yeah.
It was funny. I was taking a...
Yes, only your head.
I didn't even know the rest of the story.
I was taking a poetry class, and I ended up writing this poem about the fact that I was sick and tired of pretending that I had hair. So I had this little comb over, right? And I was like, and it was freeing for me, right? And the line of the poem was like of carefully parting my every last follicle across my empty scalp. And then I was like, and I wrote the poem and I performed it in this class. I got it was a master's level class. And I was like, you know what? I came home and I was just like, I'm gonna shave my head. And it was also somebody had also said to me, kind of like, you know, like someone made a comment. They're like, you know, people have comb overs. They don't seem like they're that confident. And I was like, is he talking about me? Am I talking about me? So it was a combination of things. And I just cut it. And I was like, God, I was really worried because I was like, is my forehead going to be jutting out, right? Like where someone, you know what I mean?
You're such a great bald person.
Well, I was very worried.
You didn't know that.
I was worried sick about it. But it was funny. My mother-in-law came over after I cut my hair. She's like, there's something different about you. What's so different about you? I was like, I don't know. Maybe I don't have hair anymore. But it was freeing. But just funny, you run into people, and there was a guy who ran into me. He's like, when did you do it? I was like, what? He was like, when did you shave your head? I said, oh, like last week. He's like, I could never do it. And he had this comb over for years. But like 10 years after that, he sent me a Facebook message. He was in Mexico. He was hammered. And he said, I just shaved my head. I finally did it. It was like 10 years after it happened. It was awesome.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's so much. Just shave it. Like everybody knows. Like everybody knows.
You're not hiding. Yes. You're not fooling anybody. It was very difficult walking down the street. This is a windy city, right? And if you have a comb, your hair is like floating.
It's
going
to go all Trumpish.
That's
funny because you saw the president on the screen, and like today's it was like it had this weird swoop like down the front over his. Like, is he trying to cover his eyebrows? I'm not sure what's. It's weird. A wave or something.
Yeah. He's just trying to cover his lack of qualifications for that job.
It's disturbing.
Oh,
yeah. Let's you need to come on a Friday night.
Yeah, I will.
I had somebody in the hallway who was there was a guest that we had who told me, he was like, you know, I know that you guys you know, on the station you talk about Trump and you know, I just want to say that I, you know, his policies are really good. I'm like, come in on a Friday night. I'd love to have you on my panel because I never have enough people who are supportive of the work that he does. So I, you know, I'm
all for conversation with people. Just don't talk over people. You know, actually have a conversation. Exactly. That's what we need more of just in general.
Doesn't happen here. That's a good thing. This is a safe place.
It's a safe place
to share your perspective, except if you're wrong.
Unless you're wrong.
Unless we talk about editing the Tom Hush, it's not going to work out.
I want to hear more of this bald man beat poetry.
Yeah, I know. I actually might need a copy of that for my life later.
I crushed it in the early 2000s.
When we come back, let's get to all the stories we didn't have a chance to get to. More in a moment on 720 WGN.
Didn't have time for it. We didn't have time to talk about it. It did not make the show. It had to go. Maybe next time. I don't know. This is the end of the show. We gotta go. The end of the show. Go slow.
It's the end of the show, and there are so many great stories that producer Tom Hush pulled for me, and I thought we'd get a chance to talk about, but we don't have any time. So I want to tell you there, you know that myth that if you drink beer before wine, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. A new study says that's not necessarily true. If you drink, you'll get drunk, and you might have a hangover. But what I love is that they had like these participants like do the research. Would you like to be part of one of those studies?
Like,
here, get hammered. Tell me how you feel.
Yeah, should have come to my family's Christmas.
That's a great way to do a study. That's a better way.
It's interesting when people say that. No, I'm okay. Yeah, they've had a bunch of drinks. I've just had three waters. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait a second.
Well, they're pacing themselves. They're hydrating.
They're hydrating, right?
They had 90 volunteers between the ages of 19 and 40. One group drank 2.5 pints of beer, followed by 4 large glasses of wine.
Oh, God.
That's a lot.
And what was the time frame on that?
It says the second group drank the same amounts, but in reverse order.
Who won?
Exactly.
No one. Everyone lost.
And they played a relay race. Each participant received a hangover score based on factors, and they all had pretty much the similar hangovers. So there you go.
I mean, I feel like there's a scale of hangovers to like mild discomfort to waking up with McDonald's on your chest.
Yeah.
And you're just like, nope, can't go anywhere today.
It's just going to be Pepto and mashed potatoes for the day. That's all. You know, not you. That's my go-to. All right.
Didn't you go to Homestretch Inn at U of I?
No.
You never went?
I never went to Homestretch Inn. Is that
a haystack?
What is it?
No, it's a truck. It was a truck stop.
No.
Oh, no. You were too busy with your...
It's not a good idea for women to go to truck stop.
Oh, Patty would have fit in well at this truck stop. Yeah. It was a very open and inclusive truck stop, for whatever that means.
Yeah, a woman's obituary joked about finally having a smoking hot body thanks to her cremation.
Wow. That's great.
Her children penned a tongue-in-cheek tribute for their mother, who was always ready for a laugh. They penned this first-person obituary in which they pretended that she boasted about finally having the smoking hot body I've always wanted, having been cremated. She died at the age of 81 on February 2nd.
And God bless her.
And that was in nice. Ontario. So.
Yeah. I like this, like, you know, when you're... It's kind of like Jon Stewart-esque, where you're...
hold on a second. Oh, there was a second page to this. Mom was never boring, Hicks' daughter Barb told Yahoo Lifestyle. Mom lived large. She would do anything for anyone, and it was rare for mom to not have a smile on her face. She was always ready for a laugh. The witty obit also said she left behind my loving husband, Ron Hicks, whom I affectionately referred to as a horse's ass. Stated which of her children, whom I tolerated over the years, was her favorite, and lamented not being around to see my sweetest grandchildren grow up to be the incredible people they are meant to be. Oh, so they're the sweet part of that. Chicago's best places to cry in public. We never got to all these places, so here's some of them. The Kathy Osterman Beach, which is a perfect place for a stroll to clear the mind. You can walk out on the concrete breakwater.
That's Harry Osterman's mom.
Is it really?
Yep.
I did not know that. Yeah. And by the way, I don't know if you want to walk out into the breakwaters while you're crying. You might think about jumping in. So I don't know if this is the best idea.
Well, if the lake's kind of low and you want to help out.
Very Chicago, though. It'd be like out on the beach where you can walk on the concrete.
Exactly. I don't know. It's good. This doesn't sound great either. The Sunken Gardens Park, which is possibly the tiniest park in Chicago, but there's nothing more satisfying than letting tears fall in a place like this little garden. There are benches all around in the Ravenswood Park Manor Park. I've never seen that one. The Logan Theater.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Really?
Yeah.
Sort of.
But isn't it redone now? Didn't they redo it?
About that. Yeah, they try to keep the old look, but yeah.
The Nature Boardwalk at Lincoln Park Zoo. Wander the winding boardwalk and have a cry by yourself, I guess.
They seem like random choices.
It does.
I feel
support
like
from the animals. Like,
you gaze at the city skyline and go, those people can afford condos and I can't.
Yeah,
exactly. It's a beautiful place to have a cry, you know.
It's near the barnyard, and that's an intense smell.
Yeah, so. It's crying for a different reason.
Yeah, my sinuses are ablaze. Navy Pier, again, another place where you can just walk.
People.
How did I get trapped here?
Cry if you have to go.
The Ferris wheel is too big.
Too many souvenirs.
Yeah, I cry every time I get lost going through all the construction into the WBZ office.
Production is just like too overwhelming.
The Daly Center Law Library.
Come on.
Really? Well, that's one too.
Yes, I would cry because that building is
horrendous. It's an eyesore.
It will make you cry.
Yes.
Yes. Because it's not a
well, especially if you're
structure.
If you're being there for an arraignment. That's not a good reason to be there.
Look at the arraignment. Yes.
Please take these
here comes the rain
off.
Again. Yes.
The CTA. Ever just missed?
No, it? Just in general.
Is that general? CTA?
Absolutely. Just in general.
That's your good. And no one's going to.
That's why I'm taking a lift
tonight. You're crying on the CTA.
Because everyone's crazy on the CTA.
Yes.
Everyone. No one gets. No one doesn't have a story that doesn't start with, I saw the craziest person on my bus today. Everyone has a story that starts that way.
Do you think people will talk, like, will let you cry if you're standing up, holding the bar on the bus or the train, or if you're sitting down, they'll let you cry? What are they most apt just to leave you alone in general? Because
yeah,
I think if you're standing up and crying, someone's going to say, hey, what's up? If you're sitting down, they're like, well, at least they're sitting down. No?
I quit drinking this past year, but before I quit drinking, I was entirely too drunk on the train and got stuck on the train in New York, and I peed my pants and cried directly into a man's face.
Oh.
God. Only in New York.
See, in New York.
Better there than here. More after this on 720.
That was a good story.